Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the FlixWise podcast. It's time for another entry into the FlixWise alternate list of greatest films of all time. As listeners know, we've been going one by one through the Sight and Sound Critics poll. But it's come to our attention that there are a number of oversights. Basically, there's a bunch of movies that should be on the list that simply aren't there, for whatever reason. Fortunately, FlixWise is here to rectify the situation. And so, with that in mind, Chris Knobloch is here to propose that we add another film to our list. Chris, what movie are we going to talk about today?
The Exorcist.
Ooh. Can we do the music? Suddenly it's an 80s cop movie.
I think that William Friedkin's Exorcist, 1973, The Exorcist, is one of the best American films ever made, personally. And I think it's one of the most powerful films I personally have ever, I've seen. I grew up Catholic, so I may be a little bit prejudiced on that, but I think on a visceral level, this film is one of the most powerful films you're ever going to see. It's about a 14-year-old girl who is having severe psychological problems, and they don't really know what it is, and it turns out the young woman is, in fact, possessed by some sort of a demon, and an exorcism by some Catholic priests are performed to rid the young woman of the demons. It was loosely based on a true story that had supposedly occurred in the late 40s in, I believe, the same area, in the Washington, D.C. area, which where most of the film takes place. Mm-hmm. But the film opens up in Iraq on a blood-red sun. It's an archaeological dig, and we're introduced to a character by the name of Father Marin, played by Max von Sydow. He comes across a small figurine that it turns out to be this figurine of an ancient Assyrian demon by the name of Pazuzu. It's a small figurine he finds. He pulls up out of the dirt, and this scary music comes up, and you see that same large life-size statue of Pazuzu with the dog with the hand straight up as if it's pledging allegiance with the wings, and it's a frightening scene. And a couple of things happen in Iraq. A carriage almost runs him over. A clock stops. There's a foreboding sense that something wicked has come into the world again. That's how it begins, and then it opens up where most of the film takes place in Georgetown, Maryland, outside of D.C., where Chris McNeil is the character played by Ellen Burstyn. She plays a celebrity, actually a famous actress who's making a film there on one of the campuses, I believe, Georgetown University campus. And she has this daughter, Reagan, played by Linda Blair. Things just start kind of going downhill for Reagan, and she starts showing signs that there's something wrong with her, and that is actually, I think, some of the more frightening moments in the film, when you see Reagan starting to do things, and things are coming over her, and she's making these drawings, these clay deals of this same dog with the wings, and she's got a Ouija board, and she's got this friend called Mr. So-and-so who would talk to her.
What was it, Mr. Howdy? Or
Mr. Howdy.
Something like that.
Mr. Yeah. Howdy. It's Mr. Howdy, and Mr. Howdy would talk to me. Her mother is an atheist or an agnostic, so they don't have any religious affiliation. But as her psychological problems deepen, we get the sense as the audience member that this is no, you know, normal growing pains this girl's going through, that she's actually becoming possessed by something. So we're also introduced to a priest by the name of Father Karras, played by Jason Miller, and he's brilliant. He was nominated for an Oscar for it. But he's a conflicted, troubled priest who feels like he's losing his faith. He feels like his life is running away from him, and he's really confused about where he's going with it. So here's this guy Karras, and here is this young woman Reagan, who's becoming possessed, and eventually the problems get so great And they've been through all of the doctors, through these crazy tests to find out. And these actually frightening scenes. They're almost like torture scenes that were overseen by these, you know, mindless, soulless machines. And they can't find anything. She starts doing superhuman things. She starts, beds are levitating and things are happening. And there's a couple of particularly gruesome scenes. I don't really know even know if I want to say on this podcast that have to do with, you know, a crucifix that what the 14-year-old Reagan does to herself with. And projectile vomiting and speaking in tongues and stuff. So anyhow, things just really descend to the point where she's left with no other options but to call on a priest, and she comes across Father Karras. And Father Karras begins this questioning of Reagan. And Reagan, at this point in the film, has already taken on that grotesque face with the yellowed eyes and the pale skin, and she's tied to this poster bed. And Reagan no longer speaks in the voice of Reagan, but speaks in the voice of a man. This demon, which supposedly inhabits Reagan, is claiming to be the devil himself, when it's a lie. And there's other inconsistencies in there. So you're not really sure, but what you're seeing is there's something evil living inside of this young girl. And I think that's one of the most disturbing aspects of the film, is that this is a 14-year-old girl. And to see, I've heard this film described as the absolute degradation of innocence. So you have a young girl who turns into this horrible thing. And that's what makes this film so powerful, is that it's just such a visceral gut experience of I think what's in all of us, the idea of good opposed to our dim understanding of what can be the most evil opposite to what that is. And that character embodies that for me. You look at movies today, like Hostel and these torture porn movies, and we're just kind of so desensitized to it that back in 1973, nothing like this had ever been seen before. So I'm sure you've heard that, you know, people were vomiting in the movie theater. People were passing out. Some guy sued Warner Brothers Pictures because he had passed out and knocked his front teeth out on the seats in front of him. It kind of shows you the date of this. Like, seats back then were actually like metal seats, you know, in movie theaters. At this point, Karras deems that he needs to go to his superiors, and he convinces them that an exorcism will be performed. So they call in the big guns. They call in Max von Sydow, and he arrives in that famous shot of the car pulling up in the fog and stepping out. And
that shot itself is easily, I think, one of the most, you know, widely recognized shots in like all of cinema.
Right.
It's incredible.
Right. Which is interesting because he is a force for good in the movie, but when you see that image, you're not sure if that specter of an image of the man with the hat approaching the house, this almost looks like the Grim Reaper, you know? It's a really weird dichotomy, you know what I mean?
And that's when the music kicks in.
And there's amazing dream sequences, and, you know, the film is just filled with this amazing imagery. And this film, when it came out, was $8 million. And that was an exorbitant amount of money. You know, so they had the money for a top-notch cast, you know, for Owen Reutzman, the DP, and for this amazing sound design, and the special effects, which were state-of-the-art back then. So if this film had a low budget, you know, I just don't think it would have the import that it has today. I mean, it really is a flawless technical film. At this point, Karras teams up with Father Marin, Max von Sydow, and Max von Sydow is preparing Karras, and he says to him, be very careful what the devil tells you, because he will mix truth with lies. And I've always thought about that phrase. I don't know why, but it's true in my life. When I'm not doing the right thing, there's always a truth involved with telling me that it is the right thing to do. Needless to say, the battle begins between the forces of good and the forces of evil. Reagan's demon kills Father Marin, and before you know that happens, Karras is being tormented by Reagan's, I guess, demon, you want to call it, by Reagan, who becomes his mother and is lying on the bed and saying, you know, "Demi, why you do this to me?" And it really harkens back to this amazing scene where his mother takes a turn for the worse, and because he's a city away, he didn't know she'd been thrown into a hospital, this dingy hospital, which turns out to be this mental ward filled with these mental patients. And it harkens almost to a scene from the Bible where Jesus is approaching lepers and the deformed. And here are these, and they're actors. You never think that they're actors. The acting is so amazing that they just look like these crazy people in the mental institution. They see him and his priest's habit, and they immediately are like clinging to him. And here is this guy, and filled with guilt over his mother, and his mother is like 20 feet away, and he just rips them off of him, like rejects them to go to his mother. And his mother, in a turn, starts blaming him for her being there. So this is a man who is an absolute torment. And here he's being tormented by Reagan. So he's outside. And Marin tells him to leave. "I can't have you here anymore." So he goes outside. So he's failed. He's failed as a priest. And he's sitting out there, and Ellen Burstyn's character looks at him and says, you know, "Do you think she's going to live?" And you see the light come on in his eyes, and he makes it. He just, I need it. It's his I'm taking action moment. And he stands up and he goes in the room, ready to take on this deal with Father Marin. And there is Father Marin on the ground, dead. Reagan's character starts giggling. Father Karras grabs the Reagan character and basically starts beating this child, scentless, trying to beat this demon out, and asks, you know, screams at this demon, says, you know, "Come inside of me, take me, take me, take me." And the demon enters him and subsequently leaves Reagan. And, you know, he rejects the demon out of him and then runs through the window and commits suicide. And that's pretty much how the film ends and how Reagan is saved.
Yes. Well, that was quite a synopsis. I got chills. I don't know about Gabe. I'm unsettled. But so this film is, I think, widely considered to be among the greatest horror films of all time.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's a notch above the rest?
It's a notch because technically it's amazing. One of the things that's so unnerving about the film is that when I watch a horror movie, I walk into a theater knowing I'm seeing a horror movie, but everything else attached to it kind of desensitizes me to the real fear. In this film, there's no scary lighting. There's no scary music. There's no real sound bed. You know what I mean? This feels like a drama, and you get sucked into this amazingly played out drama. The sound design in the film is amazing, amazing, where just something, you'll be following things very, very quiet, very quiet, and then all of a sudden something like loud will just like just invade you. And then, you know, an image that you would not believe. I mean, it's 2014, and these images in this film are still shocking to people.
I'd never seen The Exorcist before. And as I was watching it, I was sitting there fearing the worst. And as I watched the introduction and watched Max von Sydow out in the desert, I'm like, this kind of feels like an Antonioni movie. This doesn't feel like a horror film necessarily. Which really drew me in. I was very intrigued by the style right off the bat. I love that there's this slow build and the terror comes later and it builds very slowly.
I think that it's just all around this kind of film that would never be made today, just in the way that it's allowed to build. You know, that they're not in a hurry. They're just letting it build up, letting the drama build, and then that lends to, like, you know, the terror or the horror that makes it more impactful.
I agree.
And it's really artfully done. I don't know if that's true of many horror films.
I spoke to Owen Reutzman about this once. I got a chance to talk to the DP. He is Friedkin's DP. He's the guy that did The French Connection. He said, most great lighting is when most people don't even notice it's there. And that's one thing I think that's great about the film. That was a little nugget I wanted to throw in there, my little meeting with Owen Reitzman.
I'm not a horror movie fan, but I thought the film worked really well as an allegory for puberty. And I thought it served really well, like all the scenes where Ellen Burstyn is, you know, ranting and raving about how that girl upstairs is not my daughter. And I feel like a lot of parents feel that way as their children change, you know. Typically they don't become quite so monstrous, but there is this disconnect. There is this transformation that happens at that age. And while this is a very exaggerated portrayal, I thought it really got to those insecurities and that sense of removal from parent to child and then that growing stage and that period. I thought that worked really well. And I also really liked how we were never sure. The whole thing could have plausibly been that she had a psychological disorder.
Right. See, yeah, and I thought about that as well, but there are certain things that I think preclude that, namely just like her mother experiences when the bed is shaking. That's when you're kind of like, oh, okay, this isn't a psychological disorder. And then also they put that devil face in, you know, with like one frame, you know, here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Father Kara sees it in one of his dreams. But then when the mother is down in the kitchen and like the lights kind of flicker and dim, you see it on like the stove for a minute. And so I think then at those times, and again, it builds up very well as to be, well, it might be psychological. But then when those things happen, you're like, okay.
Right, right. There is this sense like, along the way, it could very easily, it could go either way. But then at the end, it does come down firmly on the side that this little girl is possessed.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I do love how there is that tension.
Yeah, and that's even like exhibited by Father Karras, who is a psychiatrist, with his not wanting it to be, you know, a demonic possession.
Right.
You know, and yeah, so that definitely like creates a lot of tension in the film. Yeah.
Right, and that's what's interesting. It's like I think the central drama is Karras's loss and lack of faith, and
mm-hmm.
you could call it just a personal journey he's on, but it's also endemic of our society, particularly in the early 70s when people's interest in the church was really waning and the introduction of psychology and science. And you know, here's this priest saying, you know, hold on a minute, you know, hold on a minute. This can be explained away. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you know, he's on this journey, you know, and we are him.
Yeah.
Because all of us, to a certain respect, unless we're some, you know, we're extremely devout. All of us, even the people who are doubt the whole question. I talked to a seminarian once about faith. And prayer and all that stuff and religion. And he said, well, it's all about faith. He said, that's the crux of it, is to believe. And I think I said, this is a long time ago, I said, well, a lot of this stuff just doesn't seem believable. And he said, well, that's the nature of faith. The power comes from trying to believe in something and saying, I'm going to believe in this, you know. And I think that's all what's down to it. You know, I'm not a religious person personally, but the film really evokes the need to have a faith in the general good of us all. And I think that's what's so powerful about the film, that it really makes us feel that on a visceral level. And I don't generally have that experience when I go see a movie. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We've had discussions about faith and religion, and Gabe is the resident religious person. So as a Catholic, I feel like you can offer a unique perspective.
Yeah, it is a very powerful movie, and they definitely Hollywoodized not many, but a couple sort of key aspects of the, you know, traditional Catholic understanding of like possession and exorcism. The first was that, you know, Father Karras says, oh, well, the first thing you'd have to do is go back to the 16th century.
Right.
And that's not really true. Every diocese in the world has a resident exorcist to this day.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And there's a really good book called Hostage to the Devil by Melchi Martin, which is the story of five modern-day Americans, their possession and exorcism. And then also, it was sort of how the film ended that was, you know, supposed to be portrayed as, I guess, as a victory of sorts, with Father Karras, you know, taking the demon into himself and then committing suicide. The battle between good and evil, between the devil and God, or the devil and priests, or and all of us, is one on a spiritual level, not necessarily on a bodily level. So the devil isn't necessarily interested in our earthly death. So Father Karras killing himself doesn't really accomplish, you know, much of a victory either way.
And, it's a good end of a movie, though.
Exactly, and that's why I say, like, it doesn't diminish the film, you know. But it certainly it was Hollywoodized, right. You know. And like I think their first interview, Father Karras asked the demon, "How long do you plan on staying?" And he says, "Until she's rotting in the ground." And that is not what the devil is interested in. You know, the devil would be interested in, well, until I get her to hell. You know, not until she dies. If he,
look, it could be interpreted that's what he meant. Number one, true. And number two, this is a demon which is claiming to be Satan himself.
Yes,
We don't know that it is the devil that, you know, Jesus, or that what's his name encountered, Judas encountered, right?
Yeah, I guess my assumption being that they all work for the guy. Even if it's not the guy, they all work for the guy.
Gotcha.
So their goal would have been...
on its board of trustees.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. their goal would have been, you know, the damnation of her soul, not, you know, to cause her bodily harm.
Regarding the ending, how do you feel about the ending? Do you like it?
Well, if you want to talk about the year 2000 version where they did, it was horrible.
Oh man, I must have watched the wrong version. Because yeah, I totally saw that version. Yeah.
So you saw the version where she's like a crab going down the stairs and.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw the other version. I was like, "Where's the crab? The stair scene?" I was all anticipating that, yeah. But that it never came. So maybe that's a good thing that I missed that.
Yeah. You didn't want to see. I didn't want to see that one. Okay. I didn't mean to. I apologize. Oh. That's my fault.
I actually saw that in the movies at a midnight theater in the middle of Times Square in New York, filled with like 90% African-American crowd. So I don't know if you've ever been to like an African-American audience watching horror movies. It's like a priceless experience. Just like, and particularly for The Exorcist, it was great. You know what I mean? It was incredible.
People love horror movies, but the Sight and Sound people apparently are not people. They're film critics. Why do you think film critics don't like horror movies?
I don't know how to say this without making them sound incredibly pretentious.
Okay.
Notice I'm putting them over on that side of the room. Okay. I'm not saying I.
No.
But
Gabe is definitely not pretentious. No. Not in the slightest.
Not somebody who'd show up on a Sunday to do a podcast.
No.
Sight and Sound. Pretentious about that, to talk about a French film.
Horror films very frequently are seen as using a lot of cheap parlor tricks so as not to be reaching, you know, the heights of cinematic genius and ingenuity. You make a very, you know, compelling argument for The Exorcist, but you're doing that by means of explaining how this is a great film. What this list is, or at least what the list should be, is about whether or not a film is a great film, regardless of genre.
Yeah. Well, Psycho's on it, right?
Psycho is on it. So Psycho and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, unless there are others on there.
Isn't
that
The Shining
I haven't seen.
On it?
Shining is not.
Shining's in the top 250.
Okay. All right. Shining is on there. Yeah, I think it is important to have more horror films represented, even though it is, again, not my favorite genre.
I don't think it is necessarily important to have genres represented mm-hmm. as so much as to have great films represented.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Whether or not, you know, whatever genre they may be in.
Yeah, I don't know. I do think in terms of our list, I do want to have more. I want to make sure that we have all genres represented. It is more. I know it's like a quota thing, but.
That's what I like have this reaction to. We certainly don't want to exclude something because it's in a specific genre. I don't like the idea that we have to include a film based on its genre.
No, certainly. I think a film needs to merit its position on our list.
Yeah, and I think there is a bit. This is my freaking humble opinion, but I think there is a prejudice towards some older movies, and they're leaving out some of the films that I think are new or newer in the past 15, 20 years that are brilliant, like Todd Haynes' film Safe. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen Safe?
I've not, but no. I really need
great
to.
Film
I know. That's like
great
that made
film.
Julianne Moore a star and everything.
It's an amazing
yeah.
film.
I would be interested to see what the average age is, perhaps. There may be a number of people making up this list that live in Europe and haven't seen a film in the last 15 years. You know? I don't know. There seems to be a certain anti-American bent.
To be fair, Tree of Life and Mulholland Drive are very high on the list.
And so. I don't know why Tree of Life. Oh, Tree of Life. It's tough to get through.
We'll get there. You gotta watch it again, Gabe.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Sean Penn. He's feeling angst. He's walking through his office. He's angst. He's alienated. Okay,
probably,
I get it. Why?
Do you think he even knew that he was in a film? They just like send. Like a crew to follow
I think
him
he
around.
Was looking at the corner of his eye, you know, yeah. Sean Penn was like, Terrence, what am I playing right yes. now? What am I doing? Oh, just get on the elevator. You're upset. Why am I upset? You don't feel sick, fulfilled in your life. Why? Well, it's your father, you know. How do I play that, you know? Just get on the elevator. Look down at the floor. I'm sorry. I'm giving my opinion. I think Terrence Malick is awesome, but... I thought that was lacking.
Anyway, back to The Exorcist. So, Gabe, yes. What do you think? Should we put this on our alternate list?
Yes, I think he made compelling arguments, again, that it's a good film and may have been things that they had an actress or even a stunt double do that I don't think was the appropriate subject of art.
It sure was terrifying.
But, yeah, I think we can go ahead and... throw it on the list.
All right, we'll put it on the list. I think it absolutely deserves more recognition than it gets. It gets a lot of recognition, at least in terms of the, you know, it's very well regarded in the American canon. I'm not sure why it didn't make the Sight and Sound list. It seems like a really obvious oversight. And this is coming from someone who is not a fan of horror films. I feel like it's really scary for young people and parents. I think... What we don't often see, we don't often show children in peril, and there's something so startling about it.
I mean, I think one of the reasons why we don't see it very often, because I think it gets to that line of whether or not we should show
right,
it.
Right,
yeah, you know,
because exploitation.
Yeah, yeah because it the innocence of youth, you know, the innocence of children, you know, it starts to toe the line. You know, and this dances all over the line and makes a mess of it.
And I guess we should talk about the film's influence. I mean, we've seen, I can't think of a possession movie that was made prior to this film, but we see them all the time now. I think this really opened up that wound that we didn't know existed. Like, we didn't know we were terrified of possession until this movie, I think.
Nirvana begins grunge and really seals it, in my opinion. And now you've got The Exorcist. It began it. It really embodied it. And everything else is just a cheap imitation.
Well said. All right. So I hereby include The Exorcist on our alternate greatest films of all time list.
Yeah. Beautiful. I'm happy about that.
Yay. And that's the way we frame it, Flixwise, that is. Do you guys think The Exorcist deserves entry into our list? Let us know if you think we made the right decision on our show page, flixwise.com. You can also stop by our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. If you or someone you love would like to propose a film for our list, please email us at info@flixwise.com. We just need a brief synopsis of the film and why you think it deserves to be considered among the greatest movies of all time. On our next show, we're back to the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. This time, we're discussing Jean-Luc Godard's groundbreaking 1960 film, Breathless. Until then, Chris, thank you so much for bringing The Exorcist to our attention.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Gabe, as always.
It's been a pleasure.
Sweet dreams, everyone.